You ever feel like you're trying to pick your way through a dense fog of opinions and beliefs?
Oh, absolutely.
Today, we're plunging into a topic that has echoed through centuries. How to spot false teachers and misleading messages.
Exactly. In a world that feels, you know, constantly awash in information, figuring out what's genuine and what's not, well, it can be a real challenge for you.
It really can. So in this deep dive, we're going to be looking at how different texts, specifically some really compelling excerpts discussing biblical perspectives from both the Old and New Testaments, have approached this issue of false teachers.
And it's important for you to know that our goal here isn't to take any particular religious stance, not at all.
Right.
Instead, we want to equip you with insights drawn directly from these sources to better grasp the underlying nature of misleading information and the dynamics that have been recognized throughout history. We're focusing on understanding the patterns, the warnings that emerge from the texts themselves.
Okay, let's unpack this then. Starting way back, maybe. Old Testament.
Good place to start.
One of the things that jumped out from our sources is that the concern wasn't just about individual false prophets,
right?
But maybe even more about the false prophetic messages themselves. Especially when people were in, say, desperate situations.
That's a crucial point for you to consider. When people are vulnerable or longing for specific outcomes, they might be more open to messages that sound appealing or offer easy solutions, regardless of whether those messages are actually, you know, grounded in reality.
And to really nail this down, there's this quote from Micah. It's pretty stark.
Which one's that?
If a liar and deceiver comes and says, I will prophesy for you plenty of wine and beer, that would be just the prophet for this people.
Wow. Yeah.
It really shines a light on how messages that tell people exactly what they want to hear can be incredibly attractive.
So tempting.
Even if they completely miss the mark on truth.
Precisely. It speaks directly to that human tendency we all have, right? To lean towards what feels good in the moment or what aligns with our desires rather than necessarily what is accurate or what will truly benefit us, you know, long term.
Now, the Old Testament also lays out what seems like a pretty direct, almost, I don't know, scientific method for testing a prophecy.
Okay.
Deuteronomy. It tells us that if a prophet speaks in the name of the Lord and that thing doesn't happen or come true, then that wasn't a message from the Lord. It was spoken presumptuously. People shouldn't worry about it.
So a very tangible way to evaluate these claims for you.
Exactly.
What's fascinating here is this emphasis on observable results, very down to earth, almost empirical, like you said.
Yeah.
And as you pointed out, it's important for you to remember the context here.
Which was?
A warning against turning to divination and other occult practices. So stick to what's verifiable from God.
Okay. Makes sense. And we have this really stark warning from Jeremiah.
Mm-hmm. Jeremiah often is pretty stark.
The prophets prophesy falsely, and the priests rule by their own power. And my people love to have it so.
Oof.
But what will you do in the end? This really drives home the societal impact, doesn't it?
It does. And that unsettling idea you mentioned earlier, that people might actually want to believe these false messages.
Yeah, building on that vulnerability point, Jeremiah gives a more sobering take on the whole society embracing it.
That's a chilling thought for you to consider, isn't it? When falsehood becomes comfortable.
Or convenient.
Or seems to align with our own self-interests, we might be less inclined to question it. Jeremiah paints a picture where, like, everyone's complicit, leaders and the people.
Okay, so shifting gears now. Moving from the Old Testament.
To the New.
Right. Our sources highlight an interesting evolution, maybe, in how false is understood.
How so?
Well, in the Old Testament, false could simply mean making an incorrect prediction.
Like we just discussed with Deuteronomy.
Exactly. Or even a non-Israelite prophet acting wrongly.
Think about someone like Balaam, for example. He pops up in the sources.
Right.
He wasn't part of the Israelite community. And even though he was, in a way, appointed by God for a specific task, his false dealings, his motivations, led to him being seen negatively. The emphasis there for you seems to be on observable actions and the accuracy of the message.
Okay, actions and accuracy. But the New Testament, it presents a different angle.
It does. It suggests that false prophets are actually influenced by, well, satanic forces.
Whoa, okay. Yeah, that's a step up.
Definitely. There's this idea that some prophets who might even seem entertaining.
The wine and beer guys again?
Maybe, or just popular figures. They could start out genuine, but then become entangled with negative influences. That's a significant departure from the Old Testament focus.
It really is. Does the source offer any hints about why that shift might have happened? Why the focus moves toward supernatural influence?
That's a really insightful question for you to ask. The shift appears to reflect maybe a deepening understanding of spiritual warfare and the potential for malevolent forces to actively work against divine purposes. It introduces a new layer for you to consider, not just human error or misjudgment,
right,
but the possibility of deliberate supernatural deception.
And then we get to the book of Revelation,
which takes it even further.
Very powerful image there of the false prophet being thrown into the lake of fire.
Yeah.
The text we're looking at even acknowledges that this might seem to conflict with the earlier Old Testament focus on false messages.
Right, the message versus the messenger.
But the end result in both scenarios is the complete removal of falsehood, eradication.
It really underscores for you the seriousness with which falsehood is regarded in these texts,
yeah.
Whether it's the deceptive content or the deceptive person.
Mm-hmm.
The ultimate outcome, according to these scriptures, is getting rid of that falsehood from the divine order. No room for it.
Okay. Now, bringing this into our modern context.
Which is always the tricky part.
It is. Our source rightly points out these biblical texts were written in a specific historical setting. They can't directly address all the complexities of today's world, obviously.
Sure.
However, the underlying principles, the warnings, they still feel incredibly relevant for you, don't they?
Absolutely. While the specific forms of worldly distraction might change, you know, from maybe too much wine and beer back then to, I don't know, endless scrolling or consumerism today, maybe.
Could be.
The fundamental warning against anything that pulls us away from our core faith, that remains pretty consistent for you.
And there's that pretty sobering prediction in the Bible about deception being so widespread in the last days that even those who are truly trying to follow God, the elect, might be led astray.
That's a really powerful statement for you to think about. The potential for massive misinformation, even affecting the faithful.
It raises a crucial question for you today, doesn't it? What are the modern equivalents of those tempting wine and beer messages?
Yeah, the ones that could blind us to deeper truths. The delivery methods have changed, for sure. Internet, social media.
Dramatically.
But the underlying appeal to our desires, our vulnerabilities, that could be very much the same.
Our source also draws a parallel between the goals of false teachers back then and what we might see today.
Like what?
Greed, lust, taking advantage of others. Opportunism.
Ah, the classics.
Seems like these motivations are pretty timeless drivers for those who seek to mislead.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture for you, it really highlights the critical role of spiritual leaders.
Right.
Pastors, priests, teachers, whatever their title. They have this responsibility, according to the text, to guide people towards genuine spiritual well-being and away from those unprofitable worldly desires, as the source puts it.
Okay, this brings us to a really intriguing idea discussed in our sources, the spirit of false prophets.
Ooh, okay. Deeper waters now.
Yeah, this delves into the nature of God and the existence of different kinds of spirits. The concept is that God's nature is multifaceted.
Not simple.
Not simple at all,
yeah.
Encompassing both love and judgment. There's this quite profound quote from Isaiah.
Let's hear it.
I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil. I, the Lord, do all these things.
Yeah, that one definitely makes you pause.
It does. This is something I've always found a bit perplexing. The idea of a benevolent God creating something intended to deceive. How does the source try to square that circle for you?
Well, it certainly challenges any simplistic understanding of the divine for you. The source suggests that God, in his ultimate sovereignty, is capable of, and perhaps even responsible for, a much wider spectrum of reality than we might easily grasp. It's not suggesting God is false.
Right. Important distinction.
But rather that in his ultimate sovereignty, he might use deceptive forces as a means of judgment or testing, maybe like a trial by fire. This doesn't absolve human responsibility, mind you, but it offers a broader theological perspective on the origins of deception, according to these texts.
And this idea extends to the creation of spirits, both good and deceptive.
Apparently so. The source touches on the idea of a divine council, and that these spirits, including potentially demons, were created with a specific purpose in mind. What's fascinating here for you is the tentative exploration of why a benevolent God might allow or even create deceptive spirits.
So what's the tentative answer?
The suggestion here is that it could be part of defining the scope of human free will.
Okay.
And testing our loyalty, our commitment to truth. It introduces this idea of a kind of cosmic tiling ground for you.
The Old Testament idea of spirits being sent as either judgment or blessing, that really reinforces this concept, doesn't it?
Yeah.
God using various means to interact.
Exactly. It moves beyond just direct intervention to a model where spiritual forces, positive and negative, can serve as instruments of divine will for you.
Now, this is where it gets really interesting. And maybe, like you said, a little controversial for some.
Brace ourselves.
Maybe slightly.
Yeah.
The source raises the possibility that God intentionally uses the spirit of falsehood. It mentions the book of Jude using the term ordination in connection with deceivers.
Ordination. Wow.
Yeah. And the story of King Ahab, where God sends a lying spirit through his prophets. Even the story of Job gets a mention.
Right. The heavenly council scene in Job.
This raises a big question for you about divine agency versus human responsibility, doesn't it?
Yeah.
If God orchestrates or permits deception, what does that imply about our choices, about truth itself?
It's heavy stuff. The source suggests this could be a form of divine judgment.
Okay.
In response to disobedience, like a kind of plague of falsehood that descends on those who have already turned away from truth.
Ah, so it's a consequence, potentially.
Potentially. It doesn't mean we're just puppets, but it does suggest a complex interplay between divine action and human choices for you to consider.
So if this spirit of falsehood is essentially unseen.
Right, it's a spirit.
How can we actually identify its presence? Our sources tell us that its carriers, the false prophets, are described for us.
How are they described?
Often presenting an outward appearance of sincerity, piety.
The mask!
Exactly. Which, of course, makes the deception even more effective for you.
That mask of outward righteousness or trustworthiness, that's a recurring pattern for you to be aware of. Really highlights the danger of judging just by appearances or charisma.
But our sources point to their doctrines, their teachings, and their actual way of life as crucial indicators for you.
Okay, so look deeper.
Right. If their teachings promote things like excessive indulgence or sexual immorality, lasciviousness is the word used.
Okay.
And if they deny the fundamental truths about Jesus, those are significant red flags. They reveal underlying motives.
These are the fruits that Jesus himself talked about, right? By their fruits, you shall know them.
Exactly.
Actions and teachings that directly contradict the core principles of faith that lead to moral compromise. Those are the warning signs for you.
Then the book of Jude is highlighted as presenting a kind of three-stage process that these false teachers often follow.
A process.
Embodied by what's called the way of Cain, the error of Balaam, and the rebellion of Korah.
Cain, Balaam, Korah.
Got it. Let's break these down for you. The way of Cain, described as starting with disobedience, acting against your God-given nature.
Okay, the initial turning away.
And ultimately leading to a state of being a wanderer, cut off, like Cain himself.
Think about Cain's intense anger, right?
Yeah.
And his blatant disregard for God's clear warning. The consequence wasn't just the murder.
No.
But that fundamental separation, a life of exile in the land of Nod, the land of wandering. This initial stage for you is about consciously turning away from a known path of righteousness.
Okay, stage one, turning away. Stage two is the error of Balaam.
Balaam again.
Yeah, this involves teaching false doctrines specifically for personal gain.
Ah, the profit motive.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And leading those who follow them into immorality and lust. The source even draws a pretty stark comparison.
To what?
To the kind of indulgence promoted by Anton Levey's satanic cult.
Wow, okay, that's blunt. So for you, it's about prioritizing profit or personal gain over principle.
Seems like it.
Balaam was willing to compromise divine guidance for financial reward, right? And his actions corrupted others, leading them down harmful paths. This stage really underscores for you the dangerous mix of greed and intentionally spreading false teaching.
Okay, Cain is turning away. Balaam is teaching falsely for gain. What's the final stage?
The rebellion of Korah.
Right. This is characterized by a rejection of established authority.
Like Moses and Aaron in Korah's case.
Exactly. Feelings of hatred, even violence.
Mm.
Potentially including religious intolerance. This is presented as the culmination of disbelief for you.
Korah directly challenged the leadership God had appointed. This final stage represents a complete break with established order.
Total rejection.
And a descent into open hostility towards God and those who represent his authority for you.
And Jude describes these false teachers in some pretty harsh terms. Spots in our feast of love.
Yeah, like blemishes on the community gathering.
Who are primarily interested in taking possessions.
Hmm.
Leading ultimately to debt, destruction, even death. It paints a grim picture for you.
It really emphasizes the damaging impact that falsehood can have, not just on one person's spiritual life, but on the whole community of believers. They're portrayed as sort of parasites within that community for you.
But importantly, our source reminds us that God's wisdom allows these spirits to exist.
Part of that bigger, complex picture we talked about.
Right. And that believers have the capacity to overcome them through their own spiritual growth.
Okay, so there's hope. There's agency.
Definitely. So when you encounter individuals or messages that seem potentially false, how should you react? What are the tools?
Good question. The key tools for you, according to the source, are discernment.
And that's more than just a gut feeling.
Right. It involves actively seeking knowledge about the person, the source of the message, not just intuition, but investigation.
Okay. Discernment through knowledge. What else?
Continuous learning and cultivating a spirit that is strengthened by love. That seems key.
Love is a strengthening force against deception.
And if you find your instincts, your gut feeling, clashing with your understanding of scripture or the facts you gather, the wise course of action is to seek counsel. Talk to other trusted believers. Confer.
Don't go it alone. Makes sense.
And ultimately, your own personal inner connection, that fellowship with God, is presented as the most reliable compass for you.
Nurturing that direct relationship.
Absolutely. And a practical step for you, consciously learn to say no to falsehood.
Wow.
By being vigilant about your own desires, remember the wine and beer, and paying close attention to your conscience. When we become desensitized to what's true and right, that's when we become much more vulnerable to being deceived.
That makes sense. Don't let the conscience go numb.
Exactly.
The final thought here seems to be that the goal isn't just about being able to identify the false prophets out there.
Important, but not the whole story.
Right. It's also about actively striving to avoid becoming one ourselves.
How do we do that?
Through consistent fellowship with God and steadfastly keeping the faith, asking questions, seeking understanding. That's healthy. That's part of growth.
Okay.
But deliberately turning away from truth, what's described as the way of Cain, that's presented as the real danger for you.
So questioning is fine. Rebellion isn't.
That seems to be the distinction. And the recommended actions, if you see someone heading down that path, prayer and gently reminding them of the core apostolic teachings.
It's a call for you to actively participate then in your own spiritual well-being and the well-being of your community. Vigilance and a deep commitment to truth. Absolutely essential.
So to bring our deep dive to a close, we really traced this thread, haven't we? Warnings against false messages, false teachers. A consistent theme throughout history.
Definitely. Viewed through slightly different lenses, maybe in the Old versus the New Testament.
Right. The focus shifts a bit.
But the core concern is there. And we've examined those patterns of behavior linked to falsehood.
That three-stage process. The way of Cain, the error of Balaam, the rebellion of Korah.
Exactly. These aren't just dusty old stories for you. They offer, well, timeless insights, really. Still incredibly relevant.
Insights into the nature of deception and guidance on how to protect yourselves, your communities.
Yeah.
So here's a final thought, maybe something provocative for you, the listener. Considering these historical perspectives, what are the modern day wine and beer messages?
Good question.
The things that might be tempting you today to overlook deeper, maybe more challenging truths.
And flowing from that, how can you actively cultivate the discernment you need to navigate them effectively? In your own life right now.
That's the crucial question for you to reflect on, isn't it? How do these ancient warnings resonate in our incredibly interconnected, information-saturated world today?
Lots to think about.
We sincerely hope this exploration has provided you with a valuable framework, at least, for understanding these enduring challenges. Keep thinking critically.
Keep questioning thoughtfully.
And keep exploring the truths that matter most to you.